Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happened to the 160 million girls and women missing from Asia and Eastern Europe, and how is their absence changing the world? It would seem many of those millions of females were simply never born, having been selectively aborted by parents who preferred to raise sons instead of daughters. And as my guest today has discovered, the United States and other wealthy Western countries have played a significant, if unintended, role in this disturbing and ultimately dangerous trend. Journalist Mara Vistadal is a Beijing-based correspondent for Science magazine. Her new book is called Unnatural Selection: Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. Mara, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show.
So let's start by talking about the natural sex ratio of newborn babies among humans, because it is typical for women to give birth to a slightly higher number of boys than girls.
Sure. Our natural ratio is 105 boys for every 100 girls. But that actually makes up for the fact that males die at higher rates throughout their lifetime. So by adulthood, it basically evens out.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the explanation is that males and boys and young men are involved in more dangerous things than girls?
Well, we don't actually know why the ratio is the way it is, but it balances out by adulthood.
Mm-hmm. So why are sons considered more desirable than daughters in certain parts of the world?
Well, parents give different reasons. So sex selection is happening in countries like China, India, but also in Albania, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Vietnam, and these are hugely different cultures. And the reasons that parents give from one culture to the next are very different. But the important thing today is that they do want boys.
Mm-hmm. And the other important thing is that until very recently, they really didn't have much choice other than to accept what nature gave them.
That's right. You know, and even in the United States until the 1970s, parents here either told researchers or showed through their behavior that they wanted at least one son.
Mm-hmm. So do the number of girls adopted abroad from countries like China play a significant role in the imbalanced ratios?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Today, the number of girls adopted out of China has fallen significantly from the 1990s. And even then, we're still talking about thousands of girls, and with sex-selective abortion, it's into the millions, tens of millions.
So what are the ratios like today in places like China and India?
Well, in China, the most recent census found a ratio of 118 boys for every 100 girls.
Mm-hmm.
India calculates sex ratios differently, but the census also found a rise over 10 years ago. In Armenia, the ratio is 120 boys for every 100 girls. So that's a huge gap. That's 5 boys for every 4 girls.
And even within those 3 countries that you mentioned, there are pockets of even more alarming disequilibrium.
That's right. Sex selection is not happening everywhere. It tends to start among the wealthy and upper classes. In urban areas, actually, and then it kind of trickles down, actually, to the rest of society.
And that's one thing that you found surprised a lot of people, who assume that this is something that people do if they're very poor, but in fact it's well-educated families that are making these decisions and families of some means.
Yeah, that's a big misconception about why sex selection occurs. You often, if you've read about it, you'll see reports of poor women in rural villages really just wanting a boy, but it turns out it's actually, in India, for example, it's much more common in Delhi than it is in poor parts of the Northeast.
So are women driving these decisions? Are they pressured by their partners? Are they pressured by their families?
Well, it's complicated. Certainly there is pressure on women to have a son. In a lot of cases, women are making the decision themselves. I think certainly for women who are highly educated, they play a larger role in that decision. But there is also pressure from society.
Mm-hmm. So sex selective abortion is illegal in many parts of the world, including the places that we've been talking about so far this afternoon. So why is it happening anyway?
Yes, not just sex-selective abortion, but actually sex determination is illegal in China and India. And it was illegal in South Korea until recently. Sex selection also occurred there. The problem is that the laws are not well enforced. So in India, only a few doctors have been prosecuted under the law that's been in place since 1994.
And it's you have sort of a double-edged sword here with ultrasound technology, because it is a valuable medical tool, and there are good reasons for having an ultrasound completely separate and apart from determining the sex of one's baby.
Oh, definitely, sure. But it is at the point in parts of Asia where ultrasound is seen just as a tool for determining sex. Mm-hmm. So I actually visited a clinic run by the Family Planning Commission, which is the institution that, or the agency that implements the one-child policy in China, and they had installed two doorknobs on the ultrasound room, and no employee was allowed to possess keys to both of the knobs at the same time. Hmm. So that was how the machine was seen, really as a danger.
So what's really interesting about this is that there may be a cost barrier, I guess. There is a cost to abortion in certain places, but there's often not a social stigma for doing this. Is that right?
Well, it's in areas where it's become very common, the attitude is kind of like, well, everybody's doing it. Mm-hmm. I spent a few weeks in northern Jiangsu province. That's the province north of Shanghai, and where the sex ratio at birth is almost 3 to 2, so very, very high. And the attitude of many parents was, well, you know, everybody else is doing it. It's become kind of normalized.
So people look at China and they think, well, the one-child policy means that people always want their one and only child to be a boy. But there are other places where you found that, in fact, it's not so much the first child that people are using this option, but if they're going to have subsequent children.
That's right. And even in China, that's true. So couples tend to, leave it to nature for the first birth. And so if you look at the sex ratios for first births, they're pretty normal in many countries, but then it's with the second birth, they spike significantly. And that's when people are really starting to select for sex. And by the time you get to the third birth, they are really skewed.
Especially, I guess, if the first two births have been girls.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So many of the parents who are selecting for boys actually already have one or two girls.
So what's happening in these places where these, you know, what were babies have grown into young women, and now there are men who cannot find enough available women to partner up with?
Well, this is just starting. So ultrasound, high-quality ultrasound became available in the early 1980s, mm-hmm. and it was widely used at the time in South Korea and Taiwan, and kind of became very popular later on in China and India, and then more recently in countries like Armenia, Albania. So that generation of extra boys from South Korea and Taiwan, they're now growing up, can't find wives, and they're going to great lengths to get them.
What's interesting about this, though, is that it seems to defy, like, the first rule you learn on the first day of Economics 101, which is that the scarcity of something makes it more valuable.
Oh, that's right. There are a number of economists who say that supply and demand applies to women, and that their value should go up as they become scarce. And actually, that's true, but in a very crude sense. Mm-hmm. So women are more valuable, but people are fighting over them. They are buying and selling brides, buying and selling women as prostitutes. And for the women themselves, actually, it's not a great situation.
So they're not buying and selling themselves. They're being bought and sold.
Right. I mean, if you think of a commodity like, if you think of oil, for example, when it becomes scarce, people fight over it. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening today.
I think one of the most chilling statements in the book, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but it's essentially that wealthy countries with the means to do so produce sons. Poor countries end up selling their daughters.
Well, that's happening in one case in particular. In Vietnam, it's become a source of women for men from around Asia, but particularly men from South Korea and Taiwan. Mm-hmm. They're going on these marriage tours. where you pay around $10,000, and that includes room and board and a flight to Ho Chi Minh City and a wife. So, and men from China are also starting to buy women from Vietnam as well. But you know, ultimately, there aren't enough women to go around.
What do we know from history, looking back at societies where, for a variety of reasons, there may have been a shortage of women to match the number of men? What tends to happen in those places?
Well, there's never been a gender imbalance of this scale.
Uh-huh.
160 million females is actually more than the entire female population of the United States. So that's a huge gap. And demographers have never seen it before. But if we look back at America's history, at the Wild West, for example, crime rates soared, murder was common, prostitution, unrest. There were actually reformers who proposed shipping in women as a way to kind of pacify men at the time.
And I guess the reason for that is that women are less aggressive than men? Is that the understanding?
Well, it sounds like a generalization, but men are responsible for much more crime than women, and more violent crime, and the surveys hold that out. Unmarried men are responsible for more crime than married men. And so when you get a society with a lot of young unmarried men, there tend to be issues.
So ultimately, Mara, this sounds like it would have to be unsustainable. I mean, if you get to a point where there are fewer and fewer women for the number of men, you'll stop reproducing very much.
That's true. Right, that's true. This. It's not everybody who's selecting for sex. It's important to remember. So there are still many women left in Asia. We're not to the point where we're going to. The population is not going extinct by any means.
Mm-hmm.
And demographers don't believe gender imbalance will be around forever. But in the 3 decades or so that it has occurred in Asia, it's caused a lot of problems.
The other surprise here is that several of the places that we've talked about are places where women's rights are growing and where, women don't report themselves to be undervalued. Can you explain that discrepancy?
Well, yeah, this is a time when women across Asia are doing better than ever before. There are more women than men admitted to PhD programs in China, many Indian women now in high political positions, and there have been a lot of advances. I spoke with Indian sociologists who described it as a sort of paradox, that this is happening at the very moment when there have been so many important advances for women.
Is the understanding still that sons will be responsible for taking care of their parents when they're older?
Well, again, there are different reasons mm-hmm. from one culture to the next. But what has happened over the past 30 to 40 years is that birth rates have fallen significantly in these countries. So women in South Korea in the 1960s, the average woman had 6 children. Today, she has just over 1. And that's a huge drop. So it may not be that a woman actually wants a son any more than before, or that her husband wants a son more than before, but that there's this new pressure on her when she's only having 1 or 2 children, and to make one of those children a boy.
Mara Vistendahl is my guest. She's a correspondent for Science Magazine based in Beijing. Her new book is called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mara Vistendahl. She's a correspondent for Science Magazine. She's based in Beijing. Her new book is called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. You can be part of our conversation by calling now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Mara, so far as we've had this conversation, it sounds like a lamentable problem that is happening somewhere else and has nothing to do with us directly here in the United States. As it turns out, though, you did some digging, and the roots of this very much lie with American and Western thinking. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I mentioned earlier that one thing that's common to the countries where sex selection occurs is that the birth rate has dropped pretty significantly. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, population growth was the issue that many people in the West were concerned about. There was concern on both the right and the left, and we had books like The Population Bomb. It was an issue that the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the World Bank, they were all working on it very vigorously. And there were some really unfortunate solutions that were tried at the time, many of them in Asia, and we're seeing the after effects of that today. But one of the solutions that was put forth in the 60s was to push along research into sex determination. That was happening for other reasons at the time. It was to help couples who were carrying sex-linked diseases. There were a number of, good reasons why sex determination was being researched, but these organizations had done studies showing that one of the reasons that couples in the developing world kept having children was that they wanted a boy, and so the idea was, why not push along that research and guarantee them that boy.
And what's so interesting about this is it's one of those things that sounded at the time like it would be better than what was being practiced then, which was this idea of, in some cases, forced sterilization, because people would come to this way to limit the size of their families voluntarily.
That's right. There was a very real, very real and present urgent concern about reducing population growth. People were living longer than ever before. We had also population projections for the first time that were relatively accurate for 20, 30 years out. And there were strategies being put forth that included birth targets, mandatory birth targets, or what became the one-child policy in China. In India, in the mid-1970s, 6 million men were sterilized, some of them forcibly, at a time when the government had suspended civil liberties and was receiving a lot of support from the West. So against that backdrop, sex selection was something that was voluntary, that, as you said, women wouldn't have to be forced to do it.
So what kind of support were we giving? We were sending over equipment. We were providing training. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, for example, there, around the same time, actually, that 6 million men in India were sterilized. This period was called the Indian Emergency. There was an experiment that's pretty well known today in India at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, which is the premier medical school, where they offered amniocentesis for the first time and for determining sex. So this was in 1975. It had just become possible to determine sex through amniocentesis. So the hospital offered it to poor women and then tracked whether they aborted based on sex. Again, this story is pretty well known, but what I found is that the Population Council had actually sent over a representative to found the department that performed these experiments. The Rockefeller Foundation provided millions of dollars of funding, and that the Population Council representative, whose name was Sheldon Siegel, had actually trained in doctors in an early form of sex determination. And by the time experiments, by the time experiments happened, the West was sort of behind the scenes in what was happening in India. But they did result in the abortion of an estimated 1,000 female fetuses in India, and there was huge outcry at the time.
So you alluded earlier to The Population Bomb, this seminal book by Paul Ehrlich, and he is still alive and a very interesting character. You actually went to talk to him about what he said in the book. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, in The Population Bomb, he mentioned pushing along research into sex determination as a means of reducing population growth in the developing world. And he did mention that couples wanted boys. So it was well known within the movement that if you developed accurate method of sex selection, it would lead to selection for males. So today he's still active in population issues. He supports much more humane strategies like backing education and work for women, which has been shown to reduce population growth as well. But, he actually didn't remember having proposed this in 1968. So it was an interesting conversation in that regard. And later on, he mentioned that, there may have been unintended consequences to his ideas.
That must have been strange for you going there ready to, have this big talk about this. And he said, didn't he say to you, did I write that? I don't remember that.
Yes, it was. It was a little strange. Yeah. But again, he does support much more humane strategies today. And at the time that he wrote The Population Bomb, this was an era when he was far from the only person pushing sex selection as a method of population control. It was sort of, unfortunately, a very favorite idea at the time.
Was it understood back then that the ratios might get significantly off where they are naturally?
It was, actually, because I found a number of articles discussing, what will happen when societies skew male.
Mm-hmm.
Some people actually predicted some of the horrible effects that we're seeing today. I found an article by a microbiologist named John Postgate. He was writing in The New Scientist in 1973, and he said, women will probably not be able to work. They may not be able to travel. We may need to protect them closely. So he foresaw that the status of women would decrease as a result of the gender imbalance.
Hmm.
But again, there were other factors contributing to why sex selection eventually took off.
The idea being that it would do more to reduce poverty and therefore have a bigger beneficial effect than whatever negatives?
Well, in other countries, the birth rate fell much more naturally. I mean, the trend around the world has been toward lower birth rates
mm-hmm.
over the past 50, 60 years. We've introduced contraception in a lot of countries. It wasn't entirely a heavy Western hand. But we did play a role in this, and that's not so much acknowledged when you read the kind of typical reports on gender imbalance in Asia.
We should talk about this country because you would think that this would be illegal here, but in fact it's not.
No, actually we are, Americans are going through in vitro fertilization to get children of specific sex. So it's possible when you get to the embryo stage to screen embryos and determine whether they're male or female. It's actually very expensive. It's close to $20,000, and IVF has a pretty low success rate. But there are Americans who are doing it simply because they want a girl or a boy, and they're not carrying any sex-linked diseases. They are often fertile, but it's happening.
And you did discover that in this country, couples tend to prefer having a girl.
Well, that's what directors of fertility clinics say.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't great data on that. I did think it was interesting that American couples had this preference for girls. But in the end, I actually didn't think it was that different from the preference for boys in many other countries.
Yeah.
I think in both cases, parents are approaching a birth as a kind of a consumer process, and with an expectations about how their child's going to turn out. And some people started referring to it as a consumer eugenics.
Yeah, well, the interesting, I don't know if you have any kids, Mara, but that all goes out the window the moment your first child is born. Whatever you imagined for it is often very different from the child you get, gender regardless.
That's right, sure.
But go ahead.
But it's an issue that's coming up with more and more questions. You know, now we can select for sex.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first non-disease condition that's possible to determine. But there, we're not far out from an era where we may be able to select for eye color, hair color, qualities like sports ability. So these are questions that we're going to have to deal with.
It would seem like a lot of pressure on any child to, you know, to be told at a certain age, well, we gave you every characteristic that was going to make you a success, and look at you now.
Right, and I think it is. I think there is a lot of pressure on the generation of extra boys who've been. There is so much expectation that went into ensuring their birth. And I think for many of them, it's not a great situation either.
I mean, you can certainly look at this as a humanitarian issue, Mara, but obviously it's a feminist issue. And there are feminists in all of the countries we've talked about other than the United States. You know, there are feminists in China and India and Armenia. What are they saying about all this?
Well, gender imbalance is a very big issue for especially feminists in India. They have worked on this very actively. There are a lot of groups, also to some extent in South Korea and Taiwan. There are groups that are dealing with the effect of all these imported women and trafficked women, which is also major human rights abuses. It's actually feminists in the West who've been more reluctant to deal with sex selection because it involves abortion in Asia. And that's a difficult issue to tackle.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually harder, there are more regulations in this country to have an abortion than there are in many places in Asia.
Oh, definitely. There's at least in the countries where sex selection is occurring, there's a very different context surrounding abortion. So in China, clinics offer student discounts. They advertise on television. That's in stark contrast to the United States, where a woman has to brave picket lines.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about this, because you make it clear that you support reproductive choice. Were you nervous at all getting into this, that you would add fuel to the fire for people who think that women should not have the right to terminate a pregnancy for whatever reason?
Well, the anti-abortion movement is working very actively on this issue. They're actually pushing through bans on sex-selective abortion state by state in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we need to have a serious discussion about what choice means and whether maybe choice isn't such a great way to frame a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy anymore, when we're moving into an era when we can choose all these other qualities. And at the same time, it's very difficult to keep quiet about the human rights abuses that are happening in Asia as a result of this imbalance. So women being kidnapped, women being bought and sold, and many other problems for society.
Do the laws that work against sex-selective abortion, you mentioned that they're not very often enforced. Is that because there's money involved for the people who are willing to do these procedures?
I did hear that criticism in India among doctors who very much oppose sex selection. They said, well, our colleagues are just making too much money at it. But some responsibility falls on the governments as well. And there, I think, actually both the Chinese and Indian governments are very concerned, Vietnamese government as well. Governments in Armenia, Azerbaijan, Albania have done basically nothing. But these are countries that are developing very quickly, and I think the first priority is on economic growth and not on sadly, on dealing with this major population issue.
How influential has international law or aid policy, things like that, been in affecting this situation?
Well, to be honest, there hasn't been a whole lot of international action. Since I wrote the book, the United Nations has issued a report on sex selection. It came out from the World Health Organization. It only took over 30 years for the UN to take a stance. That's a first step. That's good. In general, really, there just hasn't been that much international action on the issue.
I guess part of the problem, I mean, if you accept places where it's not legal to find out the sex of your baby while you're pregnant, it's really hard to say why someone is choosing to end a pregnancy, isn't it? I mean, officially?
Well, in Asia, efforts focus on sex determination and not so much on abortion. So they focus on ultrasound tests. Why are they being done? And there have been sting operations, sending in pregnant women as decoys to ask for a test. And if the doctor determines the sex, then is prosecuted when these operations occur. So that's the approach that's taken there. And there is actually, you know, almost zero discussion about outlawing abortion in China and India. It's not even on the table there.
Mm-hmm. So it's simply a matter of addressing this specific problem.
That's right. The people, you know, the problem is sex determination and people using abortion for this purpose.
My guest is Mara Vistendahl. She's a correspondent for Science magazine. Her new book is called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a correspondent for Science magazine based in Beijing, Mara Vistendahl. Her new book is called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call in now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Mara, in the places in Asia and Eastern Europe where this is increasingly common, how openly are families who have chosen to do this talking about it?
Well, as I said, I did spend quite a bit of time with families talking to them about their decisions. For the most part, people talk about what their neighbors are doing, which is like human
like everybody
nature,
else, yeah.
It's a difficult thing to discuss personally. I did speak with a few parents who told me about aborting female fetuses themselves. And one woman told me, well, it's an issue of faith, of respect, and other people in the community don't respect you if you don't do it.
So that what's interesting about that is it sounds not like free choice, but it sounds like pressure, external pressure.
Well, I mean, we have a tendency to explain things explain personal decisions as the function of external pressure as well. What was interesting about this particular woman, she's Chinese. She and her husband were really not among the poorest people in the community by any means. She very much called the shots in her relationship, and she's a strong, independent woman, was really kind of a leader in her community. And I I had just started reporting on the issue at the time. I was very surprised when she told me this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, this is an economic issue in some ways. These are countries where women are taking a greater role in the workforce. They're, you know, owning more property, making more decisions, holding higher offices. But there are still, in certain parts of the world, the issues of things like dowry. Does that play into people's thinking at all?
Well, that's a local explanation that's given in India. If you look at the numbers, again, educated and wealthy people are more likely to select for sex in India than are poor people or illiterate people. And so I don't think the economic explanation is a great one if you're middle class or upper class. But again, there's this trend preference for boys in many different countries for different reasons.
Were you able to draw any conclusions about the parts of the world where people think, gosh, I'd really like to have at least one son, but they're not engaging in this?
Well, no, it's more about what, I spoke with a demographer who went into a lot of detail about what the countries where sex selection occurs do have in common, and that is, one, this rapid drop in the birth rate,
mm-hmm.
The preference for sons, obviously, but that's the case in many different countries, and then new technology comes in, access to ultrasound is important, and also available and often quite common abortion, so that the abortion rate is high. So those are different factors that these countries share in common.
So is there reason to believe that this is a temporary thing, that at some point people will just naturally stop using this technology to select to selectively abort their children based on sex? Or do we need to stand up and do something now to keep it from getting even worse?
Well, yes, demographers don't believe it will be around forever. They believe it's a kind of transitional phenomenon that mm-hmm. countries are going through as they develop. Christophe Gilmoto is a French demographer I spoke with who mentioned that. But in the meantime, even if it lasts for 30 years, there's this whole generation in which many, many more boys than girls are born. So we do need to start looking at policy measures, at other incentives that might kind of balance the sex ratio at birth out sooner.
Incentives like perhaps paying women to carry girls to term?
Well, that's an incentive that's been tried in China and India. There isn't much evidence that it's worked.
So in other words, people took advantage if they were going to have the girl anyway, but didn't necessarily refrain from aborting a girl.
Well, the amounts that are being offered are just not enough for the families who are making these decisions. Or the programs target rural areas, which again is not where sex selection is most entrenched.
Mm-hmm.
There is a university in Bangalore that just began offering affirmative action for single daughters. So this is in India. And I think a measure like that is actually much more likely to have an effect. Because the families that are selecting for sex are interested in getting their children into a good university.
So is this, I mean, can you see this before your eyes, say, walking down the street or into a park full of toddlers in Beijing?
Not in Beijing so much, but in China, if you go to the booming cities of 1 to 2 million people along the in eastern China,
mm-hmm.
so kind of the provinces between Beijing and Shanghai, it's very obvious. You go into an elementary school, you can see many more boys than girls.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not happening in all the country, but where it is occurring, it's very obvious. And everybody in the community knows about it.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Michelle on the line in Richardson. Hello, Michelle.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a lot of Chinese friends, and I asked them about the, having one child in the family, and they told me that in the bigger cities, they tend to not mind having girls because for boys, their parents have to end up buying a house for them to find a wife in the future. I was wondering if the guest sees that kind of trend.
That is happening to some degree in cities like Beijing and Shanghai. And we talked about supply and demand earlier and the value of women supposedly going up. And if for a small group of women born into these high sex ratio areas, who are born into cities and really kind of at the top of the social spectrum, for those women, yeah, they can demand more when they get married. And yeah, it's true, there's a saying in China that a man needs to have a house and a car in order to get married.
Is there any difference in the rates of this happening among babies that are born out of wedlock?
I haven't seen that studied, no.
Mm-hmm. Is it far less common in the parts of Asia that we've been discussing than it is, say, in the United States?
Oh, for babies to be born out of wedlock?
Yeah.
I would think so, but I don't have, I'm not entirely sure on that.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do from this country if, we think this is unacceptable, but obviously we don't control the laws, we don't control the enforcement of laws in other parts of the world?
Well, I mean, this is an issue that, for example, the United Nations could take a much stronger stance on. And if you look at issues like, for example, female genital mutilation, mm-hmm. it's something that doesn't affect us in the United States for the most part. It's mostly happening in Africa, and there's a lot of action on it in the U.S. You see human rights groups taking it up. You see women's groups taking it up. And I would like for gender imbalance to become an issue like that, to become something that people are aware of.
Is there any concern that really enforcing the laws that do exist will drive birth rates back up? Because it seems to me like that's a train that's already left the station, that the decline in fertility rates in so many parts of the world is not likely to turn around anytime soon.
Right, there is a general decline or general trend toward declining birth rates. That isn't a matter of concern. In fact, many governments in Asia are worried about how to convince people to have more children. Mm-hmm. Their populations are aging very rapidly, not so much in India, but in South Korea and Taiwan.
It would seem like in a place like China, and I guess this is not the traditional way, but in this country, many times you assume that your daughter will take care of you when you're old and infirm and not so much your son. But that's not the way families have been structured in the past. Is that right?
No, although that is changing, and I spoke with parents who have recognized that today daughters may be more likely to take care of them when they get older, but still they want a son. And again, often they have one or two daughters already.
So as you started to learn more and more about this, were there things that surprised you to the extent that you had to double-check and triple-check your facts and make sure that what you were learning was actually true? I mean, were there things that shocked you?
Well, initially, it has been portrayed as something that poor women in rural villages do. Mm-hmm. And even I'd been a reporter in China for several years already, speak Chinese, and when I started working on the book, and still I was surprised at really who's doing this, where it's happening. And then also the fact that it's happening in countries like Albania, Azerbaijan, and Armenia, which have nothing in common with China culturally.
Yeah. Is there a sense in those places that it will spread to neighboring countries as well?
There are demographers who are watching statistics, birth statistics of other countries closely to see if it may spread. And I did just see a report on sex selection happening in Nepal. That's a new development.
Mm-hmm. Are there corporations that are making money from providing the equipment for at least the ultrasounds that could, I suppose there's no way to do an ultrasound without having it be possible to determine the sex of a baby.
Sure. GE does a lot of business in both China and India. And GE has actually come under pressure from activists in India and because it had so much of the market share, it's actually a joint venture with an Indian company called Wipro, and now GE Wipro requires Indian clinics who buy its equipment to sign a pledge saying that they won't use the machines for sex selection, for sex determination. But I found an article by the CEO of GE written in 2009 saying that Asia is a great growth market for the ultrasound business and that they're developing new and more portable forms of the machine.
Is it your sense that GE knows how these machines are being used, or that they, you know, as a corporation, really feel like there are health benefits to be derived from this completely divorced from the question of sex?
Oh, well, the thing is, there are health benefits,
right?
Of course.
I know,
but
mm-hmm.
they must know. Certainly, they know in India, and there's a lot of criticism of portable machines, handheld ultrasound devices, because that makes it possible for semi-trained technicians or even people who aren't really technicians to drive around and do tests on the side, and unfortunately, sex is really relatively easy to determine.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty easy to learn how to do it in an ultrasound exam.
Do you think there's an opportunity here for people on opposing sides of the reproductive choice question to come together, or is this just one more thing for them to argue over?
I hope it doesn't become one more thing for them to argue over. I don't see the two sides merging. The one thing I think everybody can agree about is that increasing the number of women born in the world is a good thing. That balance, some sort of balance in our sex ratio is good. In terms of how we achieve that, that's the question that I think will be divisive.
What sort of forum do women have in Azerbaijan or India to speak openly about their concerns about sex selective abortion?
Women are speaking very openly, but it's complicated because every country has local reasons for why it's occurring.
Yeah.
There are feminist groups are often dependent on funding from the West and then reluctant to take a certain stance on the issue. There's a whole difference of opinion about how to deal with the problem.
I'm going to have to jump in because we're out of time. I'm sorry. Mara Vistendahl is a correspondent for Science Magazine and author of the new book Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. Mara, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.